Welcome to the 10th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
A sixth of the world has just watched India beat Pakistan. The moment they finished, they promptly rushed to tune into the analysis on this podcast.
And what a game it was. Although, interestingly, after the game in the award ceremony, listening to the commentators, one of whom described this as undoubtedly one of the greatest games of all forms of cricket ever. I just wonder whether the hype overtook the occasion.
It would have had to be that to live up to the hype, wouldn't it? I mean, the hype was of such proportions that to live up to it, it would have had to be a truly extraordinary game.
Yep. But in the end, India probably quite comfortable.
It wasn't a bad game.
There were moments of real doubt when you didn't, particularly in the middle of the India innings, when you didn't really know how much they were going to post.
I think one of the pluses of it, there was no... It was the kind of game where you didn't want either side to disgrace themselves. You almost feared riots in the street if they had. And both sides acquitted themselves.
You didn't want Pakistan West Indies.
Well, and there was a moment early on when Sehwag got going and you thought, God, if India really get away here... And we're talking, say they got 350 plus, and with Pakistan's fairly fragile-looking batting line, that could have been quite brutal.
So now we know the line-up for the final. Sri Lanka, India, of course. Who's it going to be lifting that trophy?
It's slightly unfair on them maybe to call them the underdogs, but I'm going to back Sri Lanka. I think, in a sense, it's their time. They've been very successful in the one-day format for a while without... obviously going back, they won the trophy, but for a few years, certainly, they've not been able to build on that success with the trophy. And it's all about their bowling attack, I think, for me. Of all the teams there, they have the best all-round bowling attack. They don't, for me, have any overs that are bowled by real sort of filler bowlers. All their bowlers bring something to the table. I think India are really struggling against that.
And they haven't, and Sri Lanka haven't lost a match other than the Pakistan match, have they? They've put in pretty solid performances. So, I mean, the reason I've admittedly, before today when we were preparing what we were going to say today, I did back Pakistan to win this World Cup, and obviously that whole thing has now been...
That's a less successful prediction
blown
now.
Blown out of the water.
But good of you to admit to it in hindsight.
I've been very, very impressed by them, actually. Since that horrific match against New Zealand, Cameron Akmal, learning to catch was nice in the latter matches, though today he dropped a few, I think. But anyway, Pakistan aside, who obviously aren't now going to win it, and I'm not going to put money on them winning it now... India, I just wonder whether this tactic of theirs, which they sort of went with today, which is win the toss, bat first, and just score so many runs that by the halfway point...
Let's be fair, winning the toss, you know, is can't be the fundamental part of that.
It can't be the fundamental part of a game plan. No, but either way, they build their team around
I agree with you to the extent, I think, we said it at the start of the tournament, and it's as true now as it was then, for pure batting power, no lineup in this tournament had as much as they did. And if Sri Lanka do lose early wickets, I think their middle order does become vulnerable. I mean, the situation I envisage, if Sri Lanka can restrain India to, say, 270 or below, I think they've got a great chance of chasing Indian bowling attack.
Well, exactly, and I mean, Zaya Khan bowled pretty badly. I haven't seen any of today's game, but by all accounts, bowled pretty badly today, which will be a very big worry for them.
Yeah,
because
given
he has
his
been
success.
The mainstay throughout the tournament. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Khan was really seen from the start of the tournament as, and he's been the most successful seamer so far. I mean, who, in terms of surprise packages, players that you might not have expected to go on and do something, who surprised you?
I have been, as I said, I've been very impressed by Pakistan throughout quite a lot of this tournament, certainly the latter stages. And Mohammad Hafeez, who's... never really sort of grabbed the limelight before. He's played quite a few one days, and I think he's played about three tests or something. He's getting on a bit now. I think he's late 20s. And I hadn't really seen all that much of him. The first time he really changed my attention was against the West Indies. When opening the bowling, I thought, particularly with Chris Gayle really looking to sort of open the West Indies account with, you know, a few fours,
a brutal
and sixes.
Onslaught. Yeah.
I thought he bowled very intelligently and very calmly. He put a lot of flight on the ball, and then of course as an opening batsman, particularly in the West Indies match, to come out and score. I think he scored 60 odd off, faster than a runner ball.
He's really established himself as a very much a genuine all rounder.
Absolutely, he has, and it's been something I think we're going to go on and talk about is he's been a big part of what I think has been quite a refreshing emphasis on spin in this tournament. But the reason there has been this emphasis on spin is that there have been people like Hafiz who have come out and bowled very well.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, it's been a good tournament for Pakistan, this result aside, and players like him sort of give them a future, don't they? Give them something to build on. I mean, I've gone for a seamer in Tim Southey. I mean, Tim Southey's a player who made waves when he first burst onto the scene, but he's kind of slipped into the background of everyone's, he's not a player.
Well,
then that's
a bit so almost playing for this museum.
Perhaps that's the issue. Had he been at another side, perhaps that's because he did make an impression, because he burst onto the scene as a teenager and did some exciting stuff with both bat and ball, and he's kind of his performances haven't been bad, but he's not been a player who you would have really seen as one of the great young hopes. But he's had a fantastic tournament, for a team that is actually lacking in real quality seamers. 18 wickets at 17 runs apiece, an economy rate of 4.3 and over.
Fourth highest wicket taker in the
world. Well, yeah, behind Zahir Khan, no seamers had such a good tournament as him. And I think you put it in the context as well, bowling conditions that aren't always seam friendly, bowling as well without always fantastic seam support. Cracking performance against Pakistan. We talk about how Ross Taylor won that game. I mean, Southey took 3 for 25 there, was excellent in that game. And I think for him, there was some interesting stuff from Alan Donald, who's the coach at the moment, the New Zealand team, bowling coach even, saying some really exciting things about where he sees Southey going in the next couple of years.
But also, particularly in that the Pakistan match where Ross Taylor stole the headlines, he bowled some very quiet overs. That was almost what was more impressive about him, that he wasn't, doing perhaps a Steve Harmison going in and rattling helmets. He was doing a Matthew Hoggard.
And also, let's remember, very much a youngster, and cricket always generally being a game where maturity does make a huge difference. I think he's really established himself as this tournament as one of the players to watch. And it's sad, actually, that we talk about Mohammed Amir, who I think was, for many people, the seamer to watch. I mean, Southey's given himself, the some case for talking about him.
So Southey at the start of his career, there are a few who are at the end. Obviously, the final's going to be quite notable for being Muralitharan's last match for Sri Lanka. Who do you think is going to be the person come next time we're going to look back at with dewy eyes on the...
And miss, yeah.
And miss.
Well, I've gone for a slightly left-field choice here. Steve Tickelow, the Kenyan batsman, who probably should never have made it to this tournament, but this is his last tournament. And I think the point about Tickelow, as much as his achievements and as much as his quality, is I think what he stood for, he was the one associate batsman, maybe Ryan Tender-Sanchez is sort of getting there, who was taken seriously as an international quality batsman. Yep. I've never, like most international spectators, I assume, I've only ever seen him at World Cups, but he's a batsman of some class, and a batsman who was taken seriously by peers at other teams. And I think he offered a hope, and I think still did offer a prospect to associates that they could actually mix it with the bigger sides.
And he must be one of the last remaining players from that great Kenyan side, but the Kenyan side which showed so much promise in
that. And sadly, that success that's never been built on, he was part of that, and he did achieve that, and I think what he achieved, given the weakness of the side he was working within, I think makes him a significant player, and actually a significant loss, because as I said, Tender-Sanchez side, there's not really players in the Associate Nations who you see as any stand-up players you see as really world-class. What about yourself? Who will you be missing after this tournament?
Well, not a retirement per se, but a retirement from captaincy, Ricky Ponting, who I've been feeling slightly sorry.
We've all had a lot of sympathy for Ricky, haven't we?
For a few months now, he's had another fairly torrid time of it, really. And I just think that he is going to be missed as a figure in the game as a captain. Obviously, I think this is definitively now the end of an Australian era. Now he's gone as both test.
I think Ponting always got. I read actually a very good article today on it, suggesting he's often had quite a rough deal in terms of people have viewed him as a very weak tactician. But there's more to being a captain than a tactician. We talked about this a bit with the Brearley last week, and he had other sides to his game. He consistently looked like a captain who players really enjoyed to play under as well.
Yep. And he had a style of captaincy which perhaps is slightly fallen out of favour.
And a very Australian, very Australian
song. Which is to lead by your own performances and by the... I mean, he's completely the opposite to Mike Brady, in fact, in terms of the way that he led. But that rugged batsmanship, which was at the centre.
And I think as an England cricket fan, you may never like... It was hard to often like Ponting, but easy to respect and easy perhaps to fear him. Absolutely. I mean, England's tournament ended at the quarterfinals. I mean, using that old interview cliche that I'm sure was addressed to Andrew Strauss, you know, what positives can they take from a tournament? Well, an exciting tournament for them.
It was an exciting tournament for them and everyone else. But I just can't help get the feeling that for a good 20 years now, English one-day cricket has been in a bit of a rut. And on their day, England can beat anyone. On their day, they can also lose to anyone. And this is what we saw in abundance in this World Cup. And it was quite interesting that actually, I think what they've learned from, what should be learned from this World Cup is that you have to do something pretty drastic if you actually want to change that kind of status quo. And it's quite interesting seeing Michael Vaughan come out and say that he was backing Stuart Broad for the captaincy of the one-day side over Alistair Cook. And I think what he was basically trying to say is, look, we need to do something new. We need to do something drastic. Because all these... I mean, when I say tired old cricket, it was tired because obviously England had been on the road for 5 months, but it was tired old cricket just because you just get the sense that England... You know what you're getting from England is a one-day...
And you're suggesting that, I mean, maybe sometimes the best thing that's come out of it is the fact that failure will force maybe something new.
Yeah.
I mean, I take a sort of similar line on it in that... I actually think we didn't see the real England team at this World Cup. I mean, I think perhaps we saw more of that at the World 2020s back in the Caribbean, where I think a fresher team... I think we have got better at the limited overs format, but I think perhaps the greatest thing that will come out of this, I don't believe we will ever see a tour of this length again. Yep. You know, it's very easy as fans, and I think I've certainly done this at times, to say, you know, you're being paid to play cricket, you know, stop moaning, stop complaining. But this was an England team that by the end were quite patently exhausted. They didn't really want to be there anymore. And, you know, the way the player Jimmy Anderson became by the end of it. Yep. So I would hope, in terms of the positives that England will get out of this, I don't think they'll ever be forced to go through anything like this again, no. I would hope.
And I think I was reading something about in the future they're trying to time Ashes series so that they don't
to avoid with the World Cup,
so that there isn't this extended stay away from.
And I think you wonder, there's always this issue with the TV money, but perhaps it's got to a stage where if the quality of the product's so bad, you know, eventually decreases so much because of, you know, the players are exhausted, that actually even that TV money will have to perhaps drop as a consideration.
So, England are out of the World Cup, but we've got a final on Saturday, and either India or Pakistan are going to make some degree of history.
India or Sri Lanka, please.
India or Sri Lanka.
Pakistan have had their history.
I'm still heady with today's game. But what do you think, which department of the game, which aspect of the game is going to have come out as being the most... Well, come out of this World Cup most improved or most changed or...
Well, I mean, I couldn't help thinking England in their opening overs against Sri Lanka, that the ability to... I mean, this is quite maybe a niche area of the game. But the ability to strike the ball over the inner ring in those power play overs is not perhaps the pinch hitter role, but the ability to go over the top, basically, for me, has become so key within the one-day game. And there was a painful contrast between watching England scratch around in those opening overs, barely able to break the ring, and the way Dilshan and Taranga with ease went over. And I think with the limited overs game, with 2020 on with one-days, and with the fact that the power players here say that skill has never been more important, that aspect of that game, that ability to gamble and strike over the infield. So quite niche area, but I think that department of the game is clearly never been more important. What about yourself? What area of cricket has come most to the fore?
I think slightly less niche, but as I was saying with Mohammad Hafeez, I've been quite... There was a stage 2 years ago when everyone was kind of looking at Daniel Vittori and saying, thank goodness he's around, because if he wasn't, spin bowling wouldn't exist in 2020 cricket and is dying out in one-day cricket. But I think we've seen a very encouraging revival even of spin bowling in the World Cup this year. opening the bowling with spinners, spinners bowling a large number of the overs.
I suppose you could say that if it was going to happen anyway, it had to be here, didn't it? A World Cup in, you know, spin conditions.
In the subcontinent. Spinners being used for all kinds of different roles as well, being used to attack and to defend.
I think you're quite right in terms of also looking at the spin opening the bowling, how many teams have looked to that, and actually how successful the strategy's been for a lot of teams. The batsmen have often had more success going after the seamers than they have going after the spinners.
And actually, this may be connected with what you were saying with hitting the ball over the top, because actually it's more difficult to hit the ball over the top of the spud. You're taking more of a gamble off the spinners more often.
And we had, there have been some very interesting discussions. New Zealand were apparently considering playing three spinners for their game. You know, teams really, if anything shows the strength of spin, I think it would be that. From the archives, and this week we return to the last time there was a World Cup final in India. It's England, it's Australia, it's Kolkata, and it's the 8th of November, 1987.
England and Australia had seen quite a lot of each other during the previous couple of years. England had gone down to Australia and won the Ashes, of course, famously. They'd also won the World Series, and they'd won pretty comprehensively the One Days in Australia. They'd then gone on and beaten the Windies away, England that is. So it was an England side on a high. And it had a lot of experience, Gooch, Gassing, Lamb, but with youngsters like De Freitas and Small as well. England looked on top coming into this World Cup, but in the end had a pretty mixed group stages. They seem to have had a bit of a culture shock going out there. Gaston Small famously claimed that he saw stars after bowling just three balls. I think it was Phil De Freitas who drank too much Fanta before going out, and I think it was just when he was batting actually, and just spent about 10 minutes throwing up on the edge of the square.
This doesn't sound like the most professional preparation,
No, it doesn't. But they started their account in England in the World Cup with a good victory of the West Indies. They needed 91 from 10 overs with just four wickets in hand, but Alan Lamb came in to see them home. They beat the Sri Lankans twice and the West Indies again. I mean, we think our World Cup is a convoluted now, but they played both of those twice to get through to the semi-finals, where Graham Gooch swept his way to a remarkable 115, just sweeping absolutely everything that the Indian spinners bowled to him. Australia, on the other hand, had a pretty mixed World Cup. They'd opened their account with a one-run win against India, and went on to beat a pretty shoddy New Zealand side by only three runs. They went on to lose to India, but they won all their other group stage matches, and which set up a semi-final against Pakistan, the co-hosts, of course. And they made 267, and Pakistan reached 249 or struggled to 249 in reply. So both sides, after the World Cup group stages, were feeling a bit. Neither of them were on top of their game, but they both had a lot for confidence.
And I suppose, I mean, going to the tournament, this England side would have been seen as stronger than that Australia side, clearly. So, I mean, by the final, maybe things have changed slightly. It was an interesting final. You know, so often finals don't perhaps live up to the expectations that are built upon them. Australia win the toss and they go into bat, as they'd consistently done in the tournament. Jeff Marsh and David Boone, who've had a great tournament and will finish as the second and third highest run scorers, behind Gooch actually, get Australia off to a very strong start, comfortably eased to 52 off the first three overs. England, however, do fight back. The spin duo of Eddie Hevings and John Embry, along with the seam of Neil Foster, they manage to get the run rate back under control. Foster takes 1 for 38 off his 10, while Hevings manages 2 for 44. And by the time Boone's actually fallen for a determined 75, Australia are 168 for 4, and they've got just 11 overs left. So actually, they look like they might just struggle to post a really, really competitive score.
But they have wickets in hand.
They do have wickets in hand. But perhaps, you know, important to remember as well, this is in an era where, you know, the scores were less, and also that ability to score runs very quickly was, you know, was appeared to be slightly rarer. And this is made, in a lot of ways, the key phase of the game. I mean, Alan Border, the captain, makes a crucial runner ball 31. But the real hero is the much less known Mike Valletta, the wonderfully mustachioed Mike Valletta. You know, he wasn't even a natural pick always in the side, hadn't played in all the earlier games. He makes 45 off 31 balls.
Was he a test? I don't think I've ever heard of him.
He played a few tests, but, you know, never really a regular. This very much the highlight of his career. Right. And, I mean, Steve Waugh would later in his autobiography talk about the extraordinary way Valletta would dance around the crease just to sort of put the bowler off, find positions to make the big shots. I mean, they finish in the end. Valletta makes 45 off 31 balls. They finish in the end by setting England 254 to win. It's not huge, but bigger than anything else that had been chased in the tournament. They lose Tim Robinson promptly, fourth ball of the innings. But at this point, England settle quite nicely. Gooch and Athey take England to 66. Gooch then falls. The tournament's most prolific batsman falls. Gatting and Athey keep England, you'd say, on top. And at 135 for two, England are on course. You know, this is a very reachable target from that position. And then comes the moment that really perhaps gives this game its infamy. Game, yeah. Really. Yeah, it's an extraordinary moment. Gatting with Alan Border's first ball to Gatting. Gatting decides to attempt a reverse sweep. It miscues onto his shoulder and is caught behind.
You wonder how much Gatting was at this point trying to put his stamp on the game and say, his captain against captain with the very first ball, I've got the boldness. But it's almost like Sehwag in this World Cup, hitting every trying to hit every ball.
It's always a fascinating moment, isn't it? I always love it when you have a captain v captain bowling. I always think that there's that extra sort of intrigue to it. And whatever Gatting was attempting to do, you know, you wonder if much thought process goes on here. Was it pre-calculated? Was it just a sort of gut reaction? I would say in Gatting's defence, he's widely vilified for this. But actually, 135 for three, England are still in a good position. They've got batting left. You know, it's unfair to say he threw away the game. I mean, as damaging, at 170 for three, Athey has run out attempting a third, which, you know, in its own way is as damaging.
That's inexcusable.
Inexcusable indeed. With wickets falling regularly from then on in, we get to a really fascinating conclusion. Australia clearly on top, but England need 33 off the final three. They've got De Freitas and Foster at the crease. Foster very much a tail ender, but De Freitas is something of a big hitter. And De Freitas does bring the game back to life, strikes McDermott for 14 off the 48th over. Suddenly, 19 off two, and we've got ourselves, you know, a proper World Cup finale. But here comes the young Steve Waugh, who, you know, we always think of him as this sort of captain who dominated over England for such a long time. But at this point, he's as much known for his medium-fast seam. And he kills off England's World Cup hopes at this point. Miserly over, concedes to, and crucially, he gets De Freitas, who, as the one big hit who's left, is really the key man. 17 off the last overs needed. England do scrape their way to 10, but that's it. And a huge victory for Australia. You know, we've talked about how they were quite unfancied going into it. And England have never, it's never quite been so.
That might have, you know, that was one of the, because I think they got to a final before that, hadn't they? One of the finals in England.
Mm.
But you always look back on this match and say, well, if ever it were to happen that England would have won a World Cup, it would have been now.
Oh, it was a fantastic opportunity, as you said. You had a good experience in the squad. And you can't help thinking that, perhaps, you know, it's maybe wishful thinking, but perhaps if Australia hadn't won that game, you know, it gave them such a basis for their future success as well.
So the book review, and this week to Marcus Trescothick's Coming Back to Me. Trescothick, of course, known as one of England's finest ever opening batsmen, until really the publication of this book, or actually I suppose the events that caused him to go home from the 2006 Ashes in Australia. And now his reputation has been sort of taken over. No one talks about Trescothick actually really now without talking about his mental illness. And when you open this book, the first thing you read in it is the tale of him trying to go to Dubai with Somerset to sort of restart his career by going on the first tour that he's ever been to.
I mean, it's
and
an incredibly...
And breaking down, and it is the most hard-hitting account, simply because there is that disparity between this image that we have of Chess Gothic, the opening batsman, facing up to some of the finest fast bowlers in the world, you know, 2005 Ashes facing up to Brett Lee. And you just don't imagine that these two sides of someone go together.
I mean, my feeling is that you're quite... The book is... And what has made this book successful and what's made this book so fascinating, I think, is Chess Gothic's honesty about the issue of his mental illness.
It's uncomfortably honest sometimes.
You feel that it would have been possible to write this book with far less honesty. And I think you talk about how this is a man who on one side is brave enough to take on the quickest pace bowlers in the world, you know, brave enough to go out in front of, you know, millions on TV and play cricket, and at the same time is you know, deeply harmed by this illness. And I think for me, the greatest achievement of this book is it does away almost for anyone who reads it with this idea that mental illness is something that the weak-minded suffer. Chess Gothic is a fantastic sportsman, and clearly mentally very strong and mentally ambitious in so many ways. And this idea that, you know, it was mental weakness, it was nothing of the sort.
And actually, he does, you're right, blow that idea out of the water, but he never... Actually, you always end up, and actually, I was talking to someone about this the other day, actually, and they were saying, so what causes mental illness? What was it? Was it homesickness or was it? And it's a combination of various causes per se, but it's actually the irrationality of it, which is so striking.
I think that's the thing. You get these wonderfully vivid descriptions of it. I use wonderfully totally inappropriately, but you get these descriptions that actually, I remember reading it in the train and almost being uncomfortable about reading it. I almost wanted to put it away. It's hearing about someone being in that position is so uncomfortable, but the trigger is never clear, is never quite explicitly clear, and that's the one thing that the book fails to explain. But I think it fails because it's simply not possible to do.
Yep.
I don't think there is a clear rational trigger for this.
Exactly.
I mean, there's this moment where he talks about his thoughts becoming sort of beasts, bastards attacking him in waves.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember reading that, and you always recoil at that sort of description.
Yeah. It's completely brutal, and it's completely upfront with the whole. And actually, he's very tough on himself. There's a description of when he's in India and his wife's father has an accident.
Yeah.
I think he's unconscious in hospital for a while, and I think for a while it looks as if he's in a very serious state. And Chess Gothic doesn't go home. Partly because, and this was quite interesting, Vaughan tells him says to him, look, you can't, we need you here. Vaughan's just been injured and Chess Gothic's taken over the captaincy. But Chess Gothic doesn't cut himself any slack in terms of criticising himself for being completely selfish and completely wrong in what he did and putting his England career ahead of his family. But then he does go on to say that the impact of that was that his mental state got a lot worse.
Yeah, I mean,
there's a really harrowing description of a night he spends in an Indian hotel when he can't sleep and what's going through his mind at the time. And as you say, it's very vivid and very uncomfortable.
And I think, you mentioned Vaughan's reaction being like, look, mate, sort of, you know, we need you to stay. And I wouldn't blame Vaughan, and I think Chess Gothic certainly doesn't blame Vaughan, but it just showed the level of, like, lack of understanding. I mean, Duncan Fletcher later is honest enough to admit, when he hears the full details, he just says, I had no idea how bad this was. You know, and he almost seems apologetic, because I think without any sort of malicious intent, there was a sense of sort of, you know, come on, you'll be all right. Yeah. You know, you get out there, you put bat in hand, you'll get on with it.
But I wonder whether actually anything's changed, because with Michael Yardy going home from the...
Right, and this is what perhaps makes this so interesting.
That made the headlines, because it was quite a big shock that someone... And there's quite an interesting quotation on the back cover of the novel from Mike Aston, who says, all sportsmen to some degree die a death in far-off forgotten hotel rooms. And it's that image of just the sheer loneliness of the whole thing, and that, you know, it only grabs
the
headlines.
Well, Chess consistently refers to them as five-star prisons, don't you? Which, again, as fans, I think we're very willing to scoff. You're sort of like, we would kill to be in that position, as sort of the casual cricketers. You know, the idea to represent your country, to be paid well to do it, to travel the world to do it. But there is very much a loneliness to it. I mean, I found Chess Gothic's relationship with the press fascinating. Mm. I often assume that for sportsmen, the press are an irritation, obviously. But Trezeguet talks of how the sight of a camera would send a shiver down his spine. You know, he felt almost hunted. He felt haunted. I mean, the mental illness is at the core of this, but to what extent is this still a cricket book? I mean, a more conventional cricket autobiography.
Well, it doesn't really tell you very much about... It tells you a lot about a sportsman's mindset, and in that sense it's invaluable, but in the conventional sense of a cricket book, I don't think it does tell you very much. But you don't feel the lack of that, almost because you do realise at times, and I think it would be fair to say that if you were to ask, you know, someone what the five reasons were that England won the 2005 Ashes, if you asked Trezeguet, you wouldn't get the most insightful answer. He's obviously an intelligent cricketer and a good captain. But I don't think he's the kind of person who's going to be writing a kind of like Michael Vaughan's.
I agree. I thought what was fascinating actually was that I enjoyed the account of the cricket, but at the same time, I couldn't help thinking that there was this, during Trezeguet's England career, there was this incredible dramatic turnaround from the real sort of down days. And you don't quite understand why, aside from anything else. I mean, the best you get is a description of how Vaughan was an optimistic captain, but you felt there's so much more of a story to be told there as to quite how England turned it around. I mean, there are some interesting personal insights. I remember he talks about Ram Prakash and how Ram Prakash's nerves apparently were such that he physically couldn't see the ball at times. That he said, you know, and there are these sort of intriguing little insights. But I mean, it will be remembered as a book much less for what it says about cricket, but for what it more says about talented people in major situations
and
dealing with pressure.
In that sense, it's a deeply important book.
And a book, I think, that will, I can imagine, would be read beyond cricket. I would like to think would be read beyond the cricket community, perhaps. From the blogs, and this week we are looking at the Cricket Watchers Journal. TCWJ.blogspot.com. It's an interesting blog, this, partly because of the sheer level of detail. It's not one of these blogs where you get these sort of token 20, 30 line, 30 word pieces almost just to kind of keep the blog going. Every single piece, as a rule, is sort of very detailed, very thorough, and in a sense, that's quite against what blogging's often been. You know, this is often sort of, this is really sort of a newspaper, a very in-depth newspaper approach to it. There's something very enjoyable about that. We've had this discussion earlier today, actually, about how one of the pleasures of cricket journalism is its sort of, you know, thoroughness often. And the article,
just before we move onto the article, there's a great deconstruction of this idea of England having burnout, which is the, I mean, I didn't guess the end of it simply because it was so long and didn't have time. But the references that are cited, and you know, it goes back into the matches played by, Test matches played by England over the last two seasons, compares them all up and everything. But no, it's refreshing.
Yeah,
it's refreshing.
No, I mean, I think, to put it very simply, maybe to express it better, I think this idea is often that blogs should be kind of quick, that blogs should be constantly updated, and should, you know, that, you know, write down your 100-word thoughts on anything you can imagine. Almost a Twitter feed, you know, a slightly improved Twitter feed. Whereas the approach to the Cricket Watchers Journal is, frankly, that of a journal. It's thorough pieces, well-researched and well-written, and it's enjoyable for that, although, you know, harder work to get through perhaps than a blog, but more rewarding for it. I could have picked lots of articles on this. I liked its review of India's group stage game against the West Indies, purely for the fact that it did exactly what journalism should do, I think, and say things that weren't entirely obvious, particularly in its analysis of India. I loved its assessment on Mahendra Singh Dhoni's captaincy. When he decided in this game to open the bowling with Ashwin, the author suggests, was there an extent to which he had simply been pressured into being radical for the sake of it? Yeah. He was so tired of being the conservative captain, the captain without anything interesting, that he simply thought, God, I need to prove myself to be radical. And it's quite an intriguing analysis.
Particularly against the Mavericks of the West Indies.
I think Mavericks has almost been polite to this current West Indies side. But also, you know, some very interesting sort of suggestions that actually there was a lot to be said for this Indian team doing as, or that the Indian approach seemed to be doing as little as possible, and also retaining an element of surprise, perhaps, for these key matches later, which the author describes as spot matches, which I think is sort of an accurate decision, these do-or-die quarter-final, semi-final games that have, you know, no context to them, no sort of longer series
to
them.
You need to have a rabbit to pull out of the hat and be able to...
And you lose something, perhaps, if you do that entirely in the group stage. So, interesting article, lots of interesting articles, and a sort of very intriguing blogger who tries to do things a little bit differently.
And so to the debate of the week. As we prepared for this week's episode, I was reflecting on the fact that I nearly lost a lot of money by betting on Pakistan to win the World Cup. and so we decided at the last minute that what we were going to do was ask ourselves the question of whether betting on cricket increases one's enjoyment of the game. And I'm quite puritanical on such issues, and I think that emotional involvement in cricket should be the extent of what you need. You shouldn't need financial involvement to get excited. You know,
to add to your pleasure.
The heartache I have watching England. If I had money in the equation as well, well, frankly, I don't know. It'd be horrible.
It is very interesting. I mean, obviously, you know, there's no question about the popularity of it. You know, you go on Cricket Info and you're surrounded by the incentive to bet on the game. My suggestion would be that, you know, cricket's very much a statos game. It's very much sort of, it suits those of us who enjoy looking at statistics. And actually, betting's quite a natural extension of that. You know, the art of betting, I mean, some would suggest that's taking it too far, but the knack of betting is about looking at the odds. It's about looking for value.
Yeah, there is.
And that's quite a natural extension of that cricketer's fan's instinct to look at the numbers.
But doesn't it take away just the pure aesthetic? Because, I mean, what one of the things, I suppose, that is so attractive about cricket spectating is the ability, on the whole, to appreciate good sportsmanship, whoever it's coming from, and just appreciate the game as an aesthetic spectacle. So, for instance, if you can't... So if you bet on a football match and there are an X number of goals scored, it's going to be an exciting game rather than being a nil draw. Not necessarily in a one-day international, plus 300 runs being scored, records being broken, notable
statistics. I do take your point. I think one of the most things that I enjoy about cricket, one of the most wonderful things about it, is that willingness to enjoy a good game, you know, whoever's winning. I just feel that there's something to be said for that the thrill of prediction, and we all do it as fans, whether we're putting money on it or not. You know, we've done it tonight, we predicted the final. Sport, and I think, you know, maybe not cricket in particular, but sport in particular, is made more fun for fans by that, you know, who'll win question, by that, you know, largely false belief that we can make a call on the future on the basis of what we've seen, you know, on our so-called expertise.
But that can still exist. I mean, we've done it tonight, but we haven't put any money on it.
Well, maybe we should. Maybe that's where we've been going wrong. Maybe what this podcast needs... let's get rid of
so
the rest
people
of it.
Can tune in.
We need a gambling section.
If we had
a guarantees, like we gave 10 tips a week, and you know, people became rich. You know, oh God! Well, would make most people very, very, very poor indeed. I mean, I guess with betting, you know, you jokingly describe yourself as sort of puritanical at the start, but there are issues in it in terms of, you know, a lot of people do waste an awful lot of money on this. But then we waste an awful lot of money on a lot of things.
No, it's not. I'm not objecting to the wasting of money. I just think it's it can be at times. It can detract from the. Than the pure aesthetic.
I'll tell you what.
I'm sounding like
there is one way to resolve this, which is in the next episode we'll put a bet on something.
Okay.
And we'll put a bet on something, and we'll see. Well, hopefully one of us will win something, and we'll see how it'll resolve it, because we'll see how much fun we both have.
Right.
From the experience.
No. Okay. Fine. Yeah. Absolutely. Let's
right.
Do that.
And the winner will you know, be very generous in their winnings.
So tune in next time.
Tune in next time. On a slightly self-indulgent note, this has been the 10th episode. We're ecstatic that we've made it this far. And for anyone who's been unlucky enough to listen to all 10 of them, well, you're sort of a very, very rare species indeed.
Some ex-group.
But yeah, we will see you in 2 weeks' time, at which time we are going to be looking at all things county championship as well. So see you then.